What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I speak with Judy Goodman Eichels. Judy Eichels is the recipient of one Meritorious Award and three Superior Honor Awards from the Department of State. She received the 2017 Champion of Career Enhancement Award from the Associates of the American Service Worldwide. After 28 years of service in 2019, she was honored with the Director General of the Foreign Service Cup, awarded annually to one civil service employee for devotion to duty, outstanding leadership, creative innovation, and tireless pursuit of what is right. Judy has lived and worked in Brazil, Colombia, El Salvador, Greece, Mexico, and Venezuela. She also speaks Spanish and Portuguese. Judy recently published Death in Wartime China, A Daughter's Discovery, which is a book about her father's service in World War II. It is in that capacity that I had the pleasure of speaking with her. It was on a fateful day in 2016, a simple email from an interested stranger would uncover a world where her father continues to be revered as a hero. Judy would board a plane to Kunming, China, where her father is honored with a mountain memorial that heralds the bravery of a man who sacrificed his life to save his entire B-42 Liberator crew during the China-Burma-India conflict of World War II. This journey would welcome her to the country as the daughter of an important hero and lead her to create this new book, Death in Wartime China, A Daughter's Discovery. And now I give you Judy Goodman Eichels.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Okay. I'm here with Judy Goodman Eichels. Judy, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be with you, Joshua.
Oh, thank you. No, that's my pleasure. Before we get into your book, which I'm really excited to talk about, Death in Wartime China, A Daughter's Discovery, please tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Yes, well, I'm a native Texan, but I left Texas a long time ago. I had the great honor to be married to a man who was in the United States Foreign Service. And straight away out of college, when you finished graduate studies and I had finished my undergraduate degree, we took off for a career that led us to El Salvador, Mexico, Colombia, Venezuela, Brazil, and then finally Greece. It was a 31-year career for him, and it was very enjoyable. It was a real lifetime adventure. And then somewhere along the way, I picked up my own career working for the Department of State. And my work centered on work-life balance and issues for Foreign Service families, which, of course, by then, I knew a great deal about. So it was a pleasure for me. Over the years, I've done teaching, I've learned languages. And then, you know, finally, as after I retired and unfortunately my spouse passed away in 2018, I got busy writing a book. I got busy doing some research on family history, which has been very rewarding. So these days, meeting a lot of new people by the introduction of the book. I'm a swimmer, so I try to do that every day. I was actually outside yesterday, which is a little chilly. It can be done. And so, yeah, that's who I am.
Excellent. Thank you, Judy. I appreciate that. Really excited, as I mentioned, to get into the book, just to kind of lay the groundwork, I suppose. You told Joseph Author on his Technicolor Dreamcast podcast that your birth father was, to quote you, a missing element in your life growing up. Just to kind of set the table here a little bit, could you talk a little bit about that, please?
Sure. My father's name was William H. Wallace, Jr., and at 25 years of age, he sacrificed his life in China, helping the United States defend China against Japan in World War II. It's a little known part of the war. A lot of people are, when you say World War II, they think of Europe or they think of the South Pacific. Very few people associate the fact that we were working with China. And like many families were disrupted by death during the war, and mine was disrupted in that my father died before I was born. So I never knew him. He knew that his wife was pregnant. He knew that my mother was pregnant, a fact that I was able to confirm in the last couple of years by reading their correspondence, because that's a question I had always had for myself. But I'm not the only child that was born into a posthumous, you know, situation.
Yes.
Surrounded by love. I had wonderful grandparents. Eventually, my mother remarried. But it is, when you have that situation, there's always, you always have questions about who was that man? What was he like? What did he enjoy? What were his hobbies? And what was he like during the service? What did he really do? So I got to answer some of those questions recently.
Yes, you did. Yeah, thank you, Judy. I'm very interested in tracking through the book, certainly the beginning. It begins with in 2015 with a trip you took to China and one Dr. Patrick Lucas. I'd love for you to describe those events to our listeners. It's a fascinating story.
Okay, let me just start with this. There's a very well-known author, Catherine Schultz. She's written a book called Lost and Found that was published last year. And she talks about how if you find something in your life that is totally a surprise to you, but also very pleasant and also very meaningful, you sort of begin to think in terms of fate or karma or maybe God or something intervened in your life. And her description is exactly how I felt when one day in 2015, I got an email. I started calling it the Eureka email. It came from Dr. Patrick Lucas, an American who had been working in China for more than 20 years with the Asia Foundation. Totally fluent in Chinese. But can I just quickly read you the email he sent me?
Absolutely. Floor is yours, Judy.
You know, my husband had did it. He was looking at the laptop and he was going through our email and he called to me and he said, Judy, do you know anybody by the name of Patrick Lucas? And I said, no, just delete that. I don't know who that is. But I think my husband was a little bit curious and he opened it and this is what it said. Hi, Judy. I hope you will forgive me for contacting you. I'm trying to get in touch with relatives of Ernestine Davenport Goodman, whose first husband, Second Lieutenant William H. Wallace, was killed in World War II. We are desperate to find some images or more information about him for a memorial project. Signed, Pat Lucas, Country Representative in China at the Asia Foundation. Well, Joshua, I wrote back faster than you can count to three. Because I was so stunned by this. I didn't know Patrick Lucas. And never in my 70 years of life had I ever been addressed as Bill's relative or possible relative. So I wrote back really fast. Dear Dr. Lucas, Bill Wallace was my father. I never knew him. He died in China before I was born. I would love to learn more about your research and how you singled out Bill Wallace as a fallen soldier of interest. So this was my out-of-the-blue email.
Wow.
And Dr. Lucas, as it turns out, because he was living in China, and a lot of people are, you know, taken with the topics of World War II. And since he had been on site, he had been looking for the stories of American soldiers who had served there. Over 200,000 in the end had served in that part of the war. And he had found the story of my father's heroism by doing a Freedom of Information search on his last life, which is how the book starts out. That opening chapter is almost a, you know, word for word from the military recounting of the last flight that he made, which is quite heroic. Yeah, my father was the pilot for a B-24, a plane that was used all over the world in World War II. But it was very instrumental in the war in China. And do you want me to tell you the story of that last one?
Absolutely. That was my next question anyway. So go ahead. You're doing the work for me.
So just a little bit. I encourage people to look at a map of China. Usually when I'm doing live talks, I have a map of China handy. Because it shows China had been invaded by Japan as early as 1937. At the time Americans started going there. There were over 1 million Japanese soldiers in China. They had an irredentist move going on there. They wanted to take over land, and they were especially interested in harvesting the natural resources in China to fuel their industrialization and ultimately their war. So they were coming into China, robbing minerals and, you know, food resources, everything. And one of the primary entries into the country was along the Yangtze River. If you look at a map of China, the Yangtze River is huge. It's the longest river within any national boundaries anywhere. And it runs from west to east. And so they were entering from the east coast of China and coming up along the river and setting up ports. So the goal of the flyers and the bombers, both American and a British who were serving there, would be to go and bomb these sites on the river. So they're stationed at their two main stations in the very lowest part of China, in Yunnan province. It's the most southern province. Kunming and Kuilin are the two airstrips. We won't call them bases because that would give you the idea that there is real big construction, or not, let alone a radio tower. That would not have been the case. Well, so the most difficult part about this war, if you can say, was just getting there in the first place. Because when you look at the map, you realize that the only way servicemen could get there would be to come, as my father did, flew from Langley Air Force Base, which is in Virginia, to the Caribbean, to Brazil, to Africa, across the Atlantic, up through India, and then finally soaring across the Himalayas, with Mount Everest standing there as a sentinel, 5 miles high, and into southern China.
Incredible.
They couldn't go across the Pacific. There is a war going on, needless to say. And so the guys who were serving there, and they were mostly men, were in the beginning, the first crew that went over was a bit of a mercenary group. And if I say flying tigers, most people nod their heads and say, yeah, I know about the flying tigers. The flying tigers were a group of American airmen who, under the direction of General Claire Chennault, and in a secret deal between our President Roosevelt and Chiang Kai-shek, made arrangements for them to fly on behalf of China, but not lose their American citizenship. So it was an interesting arrangement that they had. And the first flying tigers that went to China, 41, 42, along in there, were mostly single, solo knights of the sky. Flying, you've seen them in those movies, you've seen them in the newsreels, solo pilots fighting it out with the Japanese Zero planes.
Mm-hmm.
But as the war went on, it became clear that having bombers in the picture would be very beneficial to take out, as I described, these bases, these Japanese bases that were increasingly popping up on the Yangtze River and in other places. So that's when my father trained on this bomber. It was a four-engine B-24 that carried 9 500-pound bombs. A big, heavy, not big in space, but very heavy.
Yes.
Very heavy. So what happened, he had done 11 missions. This was his 11th mission. He had done 10 successful missions with his bomber and his crew of seven. But on the night of June 10th, 1944, they had been out sighting places on the Yangtze, and they came back and they were supposed to land in Kuilin. And after an 11-hour mission, they did not have a lot of gas left. The gas that had to be flown every ounce over that long flight out of India. So, and also the sky was very crowded that night with Japanese spiders as well. And so the radio desk, or tower, if you would say, commanded him to go to a 2-hour flight away to the landing strip at Kunming. But Bill knew right away that he probably didn't have enough gas to make that. They did these calculations, by the way, without calculators. This is when math really made a difference.
Yeah.
The navigator sat at a little wooden table and behind the pilot with his slide rule and compass and pens and pencils. And they calculated that they didn't have enough gas, and they did.
It's incredible.
Yeah. And so they started offloading things from the plane. Anything they could get off that airplane, the undetonated, or how do you say, undetonated bombs, off they went. The bomb hoist, which is a big, heavy piece of equipment, out that went. Anything that was loose, they threw off the plane to lighten the load, but it still wasn't enough. And at some point, the engine started cutting out, first one and then two, and You know, then Bill knew that plane was going to get lost, and he wanted to save his crew. And he commanded them to parachute, which they did. And all seven of his men, including his co-pilot, parachuted safely. But when Bill parachuted, something went terribly wrong. Either the plane was too low, the mountain was too high. One of his co-pilot wrote to my mother that he may have collided with some debris midair. There's no confirmation of that in the official report. Nobody knows. So at the end of this episode, the morning was breaking over the mountains there in Kunming. The Americans started walking out of the mountain, and they eventually got to a little town, but they couldn't find their pilot. He was nowhere to be seen. And so they sent, what was interesting is the Chinese, of course, the Chinese were very honored, these Americans. They were saving their seats and saving their lives. They sent two young men out to the mountain to look for Bill, hoping to find him alive, of course, but they found that he had died. And amazingly, given the cultural differences and the superstitions about death and, you know, all the cultural things that get in the way.
Yes.
Two of these guys stayed with Bill's body for 2 days and 2 nights until the army could send horses up to bring his body down. And he was buried there in China. So this is a story that I knew, not in this great a detail, but sort of the general outlines of it. After all, I was a little girl growing up in Texas, you know. And you know, something went terribly wrong. You know what it's like to be born into tragedy. Mm. I can speak about that. I know what that feels like. I know what it feels like when you talk to your grandparents and they get a little bit sad and start asking too many questions because they're still grieving. So that's how we started off. And I never really, honestly, Joshua, expected to learn much more. I thought maybe I had some newspaper clippings from Dallas. I had, you know, Bill was an only child. I was his only child. I didn't know where I would ever be able to learn any more until Pat Lucas came along.
Wow. That's an extraordinary story, Judy. Thank you so much. I feel slightly silly asking this question now, but I think I will. What was it that made you make, I suppose we'll call it the mental decision or the realization that, hey, I need this story, this needs to live as a book? And how did you go about making the book itself?
Well, let me just mention that right after this amazing man, Pat Lucas, got in touch with me, and he realized that I was Bill's daughter, and he had been looking 10 years to find any connection. Because they had built this monument in China with Bill's name on it. Amazing. And soon after we connected on email, he got on an airplane in Beijing and flew over here to Washington, D.C. to meet me. Already, that's a pretty sweeping thing.
That's wild, yeah.
And I had to learn, you know, I didn't know who he was. And I wasn't altogether sure about his motives. But I trusted my instinct that this man was really sincere. And so Pat came to see us. And then soon thereafter, we got our children together. My daughter had the idea to go visit Bill's grave here in Arlington Cemetery. It's where he was buried. You know, when the war was over, they contacted the family and said, where would you like to receive his body? And so he's buried at Arlington Cemetery, and I live in Bethesda, Maryland. It's very close. I used to pass the cemetery almost every day on my way to work. And so we all went down there, my son and daughter, my husband, my son-in-law, my two grandsons, and we took a friend who's a photographer. She went with us to record the moment. We had all been there, of course, one time or another, and the children when they were very little, but we had never been there all as adults. And we went to Arlington Cemetery for a moment of remembrance to honor Bill together. And these beautiful pictures came back, and we put it into one of those little, you know, Snapchat or whatever they're called. No, that's not the right thing. A picture book. We put it into a picture book. And then in the picture book, I put some text about his story and our story and the day we went there and notes about Arlington Cemetery. And, you know, and I thought, well, wait a minute. I mean, it was just like a 15-page thing. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Maybe we could do more than this. And then, of course, after we went to China, I had so many wonderful stories. And I started with the idea that I just wanted to write them down. My first thought was just for the family. to make a record, a permanent record. But since I'd never written a book before, I hired an editor, which is a very smart thing to do. I mean, you know, I'm an English major, but that is not, has nothing to do with, No, that's not a term paper. So I hired a really interesting guy to be my editor. And once he looked at my first two or three chapters, he said, gee, you've got a great book here. You've got a great story here. And so he was helpful in getting me organized ahead. Well, he asked me for an outline. I'd like to see an outline of what you're planning to do. An outline. That's a good idea. So that's how I got started.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you. Yeah. Is there a particular, what should we call it, element or anecdote from the book that was particularly difficult to write?
Well, it all started falling out pretty quickly. Once I started, I wrote between January and June. Most of the narrative of the 240 pages, whatever it is, came out. I was telling you, I struggled a little bit in talking about the interactions that I had as a child with my grandparents. They never quit grieving. And when I was writing that, it kind of brought back a lot of memories. I said in the book, when I was very young, I didn't understand the word taboo. But instinctively, I knew it meant that there were some things that if you talked about them, people would get sad. So it was hard for me to write about that, but I'm glad I did. It was, by the time I wrote this book, of course, my husband had passed away. I'm so sorry that he didn't live to see it because he really wanted me to write it.
Yeah.
And he was the journalist. He was the writer in the family. But anyway, I did the best I could with it, writing it. And it allowed me to process so many things that had just been stewing in my mind. And it also allowed me to publicly thank the people who helped make our trip to China possible and who greeted us there. All these Chinese people who still remember the Americans, they greeted me like some kind of celebrity. It was stunning. I had no idea what to expect. But we had this wonderful public welcome. I met the mayor of the city and, you know, just a lot of dignitaries and a lot of people whose families have been involved in World War II. We met some really, really remarkable people. So this writing and putting it together gave me an opportunity also to thank them for their steadfast, not forgetting what Americans had done through them during the war. It was amazing.
Yeah, absolutely, Judy. One thing I'm fascinated by with any book, really, but certainly any that have sort of a historical backing to them, is the idea of research. So, you know, obviously there was the research that you did on the family side, but I'm just curious what your research process was for digging into the history, making sure that everything was verified, et cetera.
Yes. Oh, well, that is interesting because I have a whole bookshelf up here, books on World War II. I read a lot about Claire Chennault, and there is actually, I found two references to Bill quite accidentally in books that I used for research. One about the 308th Bombardment Group of the 425th Division of the 14th Army. I mean, yes, there it was, his name twice in two references that I had. I could probably get them. And then I have a friend who is a World War II history buff. And when he learned about my trip to China, he scoured used bookstores around Washington and brought me several books. Barbara Tuchman's book on Stillman, General Stillman and the war in China was very helpful to me. And I don't know, I have 8 or 10 books that I referenced. And then I used the Library of Congress, which is here. I got some reference from them and also the National Archives. My husband and I, on one of our trips to Texas, made a stop at the library, the Central Library in Dallas, Texas, where I got copies of newspaper articles that were published at the time. And some I had here rather frayed and so forth that had been saved for me. But that was helpful. And then I had some serendipity is just, if I wanted to rename this book, I'd just call it Serendipity. I made it my job to get on a B-24. Let me just quickly refer to one thing that my editor said to me one day. We were talking and he was getting ready to leave the house. We'd had coffee and we looked at some stuff. And just as he was walking out the door, he had 1 foot out the front door and he turned around to me and he said, Judy, what you need to do is to get on that airplane and fly that last flight with your father. Whoa. That's a perspective.
Yeah.
Get on that airplane and fly that flight with your father, which is the reason I start the book with that flight information, that last flight information. But then I got to thinking to myself, is there a B-24 anywhere around here? And there was one Joshua in the United States of America in 2016.
Wow.
It was part of something called the Collins Foundation. They were maintaining these old wartime aircraft and flying them around the United States, including the B-17, B-29, a P-40. They sometimes fly at air shows, but they go to these little airports around and you can get on them. And this was in 2016 when we got home from China. They were parked up at a airport in Altoona, Pennsylvania, which is not that far from Washington, D.C. So we packed up the whole family in the minivan and we went up to Altoona, Pennsylvania. And I got myself on a B-24. And it was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. I really recommend this kind of thing to people who are trying to write about history. If you haven't touched it or seen it, try to get someplace where you can see it or visit a house that's more or less the same place or the same age as what you're writing about. Because it really, being on that airplane changed my whole picture about what happened that night. You know, what happened the night he died.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wow. I'm very curious about what the reader feedback has been. What are some of the most, let's say, memorable responses that you've received from readers of the book?
Well, one person said that she didn't want to put it down. She didn't want the story to be over. Other people have said, I've gotten several interesting reviews on Amazon. And many people expressed surprise. They didn't know that Americans were participating in a war in China. They didn't know that. And so, you know, and other people have talked about how do you get to know the parent that you never knew as a topic and maybe something that they had experienced. And I've had people say that they can hear my voice when they read the book and a lot of positive comments. Interestingly, the group of people that have been most supportive of this book are Chinese Americans.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, isn't it?
Yeah. What makes you, what can you glean any guesses why that might be?
Because the Chinese in this Washington community are numerous. They even have their own newspaper. And when the book came out, I made a serendipitous connection. The back of the book and on one of the inside pages has a beautiful calligraphy here. And this calligraphy was done by John S.C. Wang. It was introduced to me by a Chinese woman I met by chance at a black tie dinner. I had been wanting a calligraphy for my book. And I showed her what I had so far. I got it from somebody at Etsy. And she looked at it and she said, well, I think you can do better than this. What's that? What did I know? I didn't know anything. And so she introduced me to this very famous calligrapher who I think everybody in the Chinese community knows. And from there, things just kind of took off. I spoke and invited me to speak at a Chinese Writers Association. There was another writer there that night and I did a little mini introduction to my book. There were over 100 people there. And then I was invited to another group called Tea for Soul, which is Chinese cultural group. And it was so interesting because they had relatives, of course they did, who were in the war. Now, the other thing I would say right now, given what's happened recently in the news with the shooting down of that balloon, but with other things that have gone on in the community, I think the Asian community has been quite under attack in the United States. Even though many of them have been here now two generations, I think it's not easy for them. And here I am with nothing but gratitude for the service and for the fact that, you know, they welcomed me to China. One of the dinners that they had for me, there was a sign over the front of the civic hall that said, "Welcome, Judy Eichels. To be the daughter of a hero is the highest honor."
Wow, that's incredible.
It's incredible. So, I mean, none of this, you know, and I think it, from my own experience living in six overseas, you know, six different cultures overseas, I know how easy it is to stereotype, but how rewarding it is if you can just get beyond language and beyond appearances and beyond geography and beyond politics. You usually find people were very much like you.
Mm-hmm.
They just want to take care of their families. They want to raise their children. They want to go to school. They want to be at peace. And so I think this story about Bill's heroism in this time of American and Chinese alliance is very welcome in that community right now.
Excellent. Yeah, that's well said, Judy. I think the last thing you said about getting past politics, I think would be particularly salient, especially these days. You know what, Judy, you may have already answered it. And if you did, just let me know. I'll move on. But I am curious if you have any further thoughts on how the events and the experiences described in the book might be relevant to today's world and any lessons that we might be able to learn from it.
Well, just to amplify this previous comment.
Yes.
And that is that I think people in the world are much more alike than they are different. I can say that from personal experience. And I can also say it's not necessarily easy to get beyond square one.
Yeah, that's true.
It takes being a little bit open-minded, not a little bit, quite a bit.
Yeah.
Open-minded and open to the idea that someone, if you just talk with them long enough, they might have some words of wisdom for you or be able to show you things that you wouldn't have been able to see otherwise. So I encourage, I know travel is hard these days. We've all been cooped up for 2 years or longer. And that's, of course, that kind of helped me in a way to write the book because I was grounded here. But I think we have to just concentrate on our humanity and the humanity that other people have and look at that and try to get along.
Yeah, very well said. Confirmation bias is a real thing. We all have it. You know, we all do it. One of my favorite things, just as kind of an aside, I do always chuckle when I hear someone say, well, I'm not judgmental, or I don't judge people. Yes, you do. Doesn't make you a bad person. It just makes you human, right? And yeah, I think that's a decent way of thinking about solving the stereotyping issue. Let me see. I am curious, Judy, are there any other projects that you're working on aside from the book? I know that you're a poet as well, correct?
Yes, I've written some poetry. It just, you know, I go in waves with this poetry. One thing that was really interesting to me when I did my research and started, you know, my mother saved me a little box, a little treasure trove of the letters that she and Bill exchanged.
Mm.
And also there was he wrote poetry to her all the time. And it was really, I don't know why it had never dawned on me that maybe I sort of got that from my father. My mother certainly never wrote it for anybody else in the family. So that has been an interesting way for me to get in touch with some of my feelings about this.
Interesting.
But also, when you go back and look at that, and you're, you know, is everybody just trying for their whole entire life to figure out that they really are? I don't know. But I guess in my parents' relationship, you know, they went to high school together, and I went to the same high school they did. All of us went
wow.
to high school. And he had his eye on her from very early on. And he wrote her these little poems and she kept them. This is what's so interesting. Oh, I know they were just in high school, but then it was 5 years before they married. And he kept writing her poetry.
That's sweet.
And I think sometimes it must have been kind of a rocky road because then the poems are really, you know, distraught. Like, would she ever be able to say yes? She finally did.
That's wonderful, Judy. Just have a couple questions left, Judy, and then I think we should be good. I suppose I'll ask, what is it that you are hoping people get from the book, if anything? What's a message that you're looking to send?
One message is it's never too late. It is never, if there's something in your history, your own history that you're curious about or that you've never fully been able to resolve in your own mind, unless you're dead, it's never too late to do some research, to find some people to talk to who may have had similar experiences. And if you do, it's very rewarding. I think it's very rewarding. I know that I've met people when I do book talks that say, oh, I always have been wondering about, so I don't know how to research that. I don't know. And I encourage people, they're really curious, get after it because it can be extremely rewarding. I could say it's not, things are not too far. I mean, it's never too far. I went to China, for heaven's sakes. I've never been to China. I went to China and I saw a memorial with my father's name on it. dedicated to American and Chinese friendship. I mean, what price can... Yeah, it was an expensive trip. So what? I got to see something that really, you know, changed my life. So I think that's the message. I think the message is that even, you know, you can get to know people that you never knew if you just put in a little effort.
Beautiful. I love it, Judy. Thank you. Judy Goodman-Eichels, how can people find out about you?
Oh, you know, social media is out there. Just Google my name. You'll run across a lot of stuff. I worked at the State Department for, you know, nearly 30 years, 28 years. So there's a lot of stuff out there. And the book is on Amazon, of course. But it's also available other places. It's available and local bookstores can order it for you. If you have a favorite independent bookstore that you like to support so they don't go out of business, which I think is a worthy thing to do, you can find it there.
Excellent. And the book, once again, is Death in Wartime China, A Daughter's Discovery. Judy Goodman-Eichels, this was such a pleasure. Thank you for speaking to me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Joshua. It was a pleasure for me. I love to tell my story.
And I'm happy to hear it. I will let you go, Judy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.